Thank you for the introduction. Also, thanks to your organizers, especially Alex and Benny, for giving me the opportunity to speak here. This talk is based on a joint work with Kun Fang from Cambridge. Here's the archive number. These are the three main results I'm going to talk about today. So the first two are general results, which are already in the title. And the third one is a lower bound on the overhead of metastate distillation, which happens to be one of the themes of this conference. Let's start from a bit of motivation. So currently, we're in a quite exciting era where we understand better and better the huge potentials of quantum technologies. But at the same time, the noise is still imposing like serious challenges on us before we can really realize its full power. So that's because like quantum systems are intrinsically very susceptible to all kinds of noise effects. And the general effect of the noises will make the quantum systems highly mixed. And therefore, they could become unreliable for direct usage or lose its power. Therefore, we have to work really hard on error correction, noise mitigation, and fault tolerance techniques. Right? Understanding the ultimate limit of the efficiency of such procedures will be of great importance. So this is the super general form of the task we are going to consider today. So we start from a noisy, highly mixed state rho, and we want to transform it to a pure state psi, sometimes approximately. So this is the task we call purification. A very simple example is the error correction. Where you usually start from a bunch of noisy qubits, and you do encoding, physical operations, decoding, and all kinds of stuff, and you want to end up with some rather clean logical qubits. So here, the noisy qubits is like the row here, and the logical clean logical qubits is the target pure state we want. So we need to notice that in practical scenarios, we are never allowed the power of doing any operation we want. Practical scenarios will always entail some physical limitations. So taking a cue from economics, if something is hard to obtain, then it acquires resource values. There are many very good examples in the quantum context. So first of all, in the familiar distant lab paradigm, the local operations and classical communication is considered to be cheap. And in this context, the entanglement will emerge as a resource. It's useful, it can enable efficient quantum communication. And also at the same time, it cannot be created by LOCC. So that's why we consider it to be a resource. And the second one for fault tolerance, the stabilizer circuits are considered to be cheap, thanks to stabilizer circles. Here, the magic states will become resource. It can enable universal quantum computation. I'll discuss about this later. There are many other different types of quantum resources, like coherence, asymmetry, ethermality, Bell non-locality, where Rob Speckens talked about a few days ago, non-Gaussianity. There are many, many different possibilities. And also, like there are many experts sitting in this room on many of these topics. In different scenarios, they can be considered to be the origin of quantum advantage or quantum features. So this is cast under a very general framework called the resource theory. You can also check out a few other talks in this conference. So resource theory, this framework abstracts out the structure of the problem that we are looking at. So here, the right way to formulate these kind of problem on under physical limitations is to study the manipulation of resources under free operations. So what are these free operations? Here, we consider this golden rule. So this golden rule is very simple. A free operation can only map a free state to another free state. So in some literature, this is called the resource non-generating operations. And also notice that this is the minimal condition for a non-trivial theory, in the sense that if your operation is able to map a free state to a non-free state, then it just generates resource by itself, and therefore trivializing the theory. So the set of operations selected out by this golden rule will include all possible sets of free operations that you possibly want to allow in the resource theory. So what is impossible for this set of operations is automatically impossible for all theories. So we make a small modification of the general task. Here we consider this transformation from a noisy resource state row to a pure target resource state psi we want by free operations. And now we ask whether this is possible or not. And there's another important feature of the setting we consider. So in practice, we are always only given a finite amount of resources. This is usually called the one-shot or single-shot setting. Also, some error could just be allowed. This is in contrast to the asymptotic setting, which is a very conventional one in information theory. There, we consider the limit of infinite IID instances of the resources for simplification. But here, the rho and psi are all just finite sets. For example, the rho and psi here can be finite copies of some unit states we want, or some codes of finite size. But the point is that we are not considering the n copies of rho transforming to m copies of psi, where we take the limit of n tending to infinity, which is a traditional one in information theory that you might be familiar with. So a prequel to this work is a unified theory of resource monotones that quantify the values of resources in one-shot setting. This is another earlier work this year, which kind of paves the way for the observations in this work. All right, so throughout this talk, I will make one simplifying assumption, which is that the initial state rho is full rank. So this is quite generically true in practical scenarios. Suppose your system has any like depolarizing component in the noise, then it's necessary full rank. Also, maybe there is some thermal noise with full rank Hamiltonian, then it's just full rank. Other than that, we don't really need any other assumptions. So the results I'm going to talk about in, later applies to any kind of resources, resource theories. Well, maybe other than the trivial assumption that there must be some non-free pure state in the theory, but this is just trivial. Like some pure state has to be non-free. Otherwise, this task is not really well defined. And also it applies to any pure non-free state as the target, however weak it is. This is sort of surprising, as I'll explain later. And also it applies to any free operation. As I said, we only need the golden rule, which is the minimal constraint on a legit procedure you want to allow. All right, so first, for intuition, let's consider the case of quantum channels, which are trace preserving. This represents the deterministic protocols that do not use post-selection. This is a simple case. Let's start with it. So the form of the result looked like this. Given any full rank state, primitive state rho, and any pure target resource state psi, the error epsilon of any free transformation by a channel must satisfy this lower bound. So here, the lambda min is just the smallest eigenvalue of rho. So this smallest eigenvalue is also related to the strength of the noise. So for example, if your system is like completely depolarizing, then this smallest eigenvalue is just maximal, 1 over d. Also, this f sub psi denotes the maximum overlap or fidelity with the free states. So because psi is a pure non-free state, it is smaller than 1. So this makes the whole bound just greater than 0. So this says that any free channel cannot map any full rank resource state to an epsilon vicinity of a target state psi. This is the simple message that this result conveys. So let's look at the rough idea of the proof. So for the proof included in the paper, we need to make use of an information theoretic tool, which is called the quantum hypothesis testing relative entropy, defined like this. So what is this quantity? So it is a divergence type measure of rho and sigma two states based on the error probability of distinguishing the two states, which is sometimes called hypothesis testing. So this trace part is relevant to the error probability, and we take this minus log to make it like a divergence. So for example, if you take rho equals sigma, then you can easily check that this is just zero. When we take epsilon equals zero, what we get is this quantity, where the pi sub rho is the projector onto the support of rho. So this quantity is called the mean relative entropy. It is also just the zero order limit of the Rayleigh divergence. So recall that the Rayleigh divergence is non-decreasing in the increasing of the order. So this is the smallest among the Rayleigh family. And our hypothesis testing relative entropy is just a smooth version with some finite epsilon of this mean relative entropy. So you can intuitively consider it to be also very small. Now we take minimization over all free states sigma. This will give us a resource monotone, which means that this resource measure is non-increasing under all free operations. This is due to the data processing inequality of the hypothesis testing relative entropy proved in this paper. So let me know that the modified versions of this resource monotone based on hypothesis testing relative entropy is known to upper bound the general one-shot distillation rates. This is a result in the early paper. All right, so to obtain the proof, we essentially just stare at this monotone. So let's first consider the zero error version. As I commented, this quantity is usually very small. And when under our assumption that rho is full rank, you can easily see that this quantity is always zero, because the projector is just onto the whole space. And it's just minus log trace density operator. So it's always zero. And epsilon here characterizes the transformation error. So to account for approximate transformation, we need to derive some continuity bound. So the result looks like this. It says that for a sufficiently small error, which is smaller than the mean eigenvalue, this quantity, the hypothesis testing relative entropy, will be continuous. It's continuous around epsilon equals zero. So that means that it's also going to be very small, arbitrarily small, in the vicinity of full rank states. So the conclusion of this is the hypothesis testing relative entropy monotone can be made arbitrarily small by decreasing the area one for all full rank resource states. But another observation is that for pure state, it will be just lower bounded by a constant. It cannot be made arbitrarily small. So by suitably combining the above continuity bound and the monotonicity of the resource monotones, it means that you cannot transform a state with a lower monotone to a state with a larger monotone. You can easily obtain the claimed accuracy bound.
So I don't quite get this point about it's only for all four rank states. So
sorry?
Is it the pure states you get a constant per bound?
Oh, I'm talking about the resource monotone for pure state. So this pure state is the rho here. It's not full rank. It's just some finite value. It's a pure state if you look at this expression. Yeah. So what it does is it projects onto the support of rho, right? So if rho is a pure state, then it's not going to be zero. It's some finite value. Any other questions? Okay, let's move on. So there is actually an alternative proof, which is based on the overlap formalism defined in another recent paper. We didn't include this proof in the archive paper, but yeah, I'd like to credit Ryuji Takagi and Kyung Jun Nu for drawing my attention to this alternative proof. So this pretty technical theorem is proved in this other paper. What this expression says is that, so this is, sorry, I did not define it. So this is the maximum fidelity of the transformation. So this this says that if you want to transform rho to some psi, the maximum fidelity that you can get is upper bounded by this optimization problem. And we can try to solve this optimization problem by looking at its dual. And we know that the strong duality holds for finite dimensions, but we don't actually need it. So the dual optimization problem looks like this. So here, there's some freedom for us to play around with this operator x. So for any x, it is shown that the optimum is achieved by these two operators. So we can rewrite the optimization problem like this. And if we just take the operator x to be lambda min of rho times a free state sigma, then we can recover the bound introduced in earlier slides. This gives us some possibility of improving the bound for certain cases, but this is maybe future work. All right, so this is the toy case, the deterministic transformation. But in practice, we also care about probabilistic transformation. Because, for example, for error correction subroutine, you often it often just succeeds probabilistically upon passing some syndrome measurements. So here, the model is like this. A free probabilistic protocol with success probability p and error epsilon is described by this flagged transformation. Here, the register x is a flagged register. You can understand it as an eternal label that records whether the protocol succeeds or not. And here we require the L and G to be free sub-operations, which is a completely positive trace not increasing maps under the similar golden rule. And the properties of these sub-channels are these. So the trace of the output of this sub-channel is a P tensor of some state. So that corresponds to the success probability P. And that means, like, if you measure the flag register, the probability of getting zero, which means success, is P. And then you want this target state to be epsilon close to the target, this output state, to be epsilon close to the target state psi. And the G is just garbage, because one means failure here. Any question about this setting? Good. So the no-go theorem for the probabilistic setting looks like this. It's just slightly different. So here, again, for any four-rank state rho and any pure target resource state psi, the success probability p and error epsilon of any free probabilistic transformation satisfies this relation. So here in the deterministic bound, p is 1, but here the bound is expressed in terms of epsilon over p. So this quantity is called the generalized robustness, which was already defined by Earl in for magic. But this quantity just show up for technical reasons here. So to prove this probabilistic version, we need these two rather technical facts of the quantities we care about. So the first quantity really just says that. So this beta is 2 to the minus hypothesis testing relative entropy. It basically just says that the overlap of rho and sigma is controlled by the overlap of its arms. So if the overlap of these components are somewhat small, then the overall overlap cannot be too large. And this robustness quantity just show up in this technical fact due to linearity. But the whole idea is very, very similarly follows as the deterministic case. All right, so here is a summary of what the results is saying. So what we observe from the bounds is that there is a fundamental trade-off between the accuracy and the success probability of these transformation protocols. This is akin to some uncertainty principle. Not really, but yeah, you get the idea. So this is a diagram summarizing the results. The x-axis is the success probability p, and the y-axis is the error epsilon. So to achieve a higher accuracy, like for example, you want to go to this region, you really have to decrease the success probability p. So this is expressed in terms of this forbidden region. This says that no legitimate protocol with the corresponding parameters can reach this forbidden region. So a corollary is that a perfect resource purification is never possible, even probabilistically, so which corresponds to the case of epsilon equals zero. All right, now let's remark on the results. So let's consider a special case where you take rho to be a slightly contaminated version of some very powerful resource state. And psi is a target, it's a pure target state, but it's very weak. So for example, in the context, so this diagram is drawn in the context of coherence theory where the diagonal density matrices are free. But for magic theory, let's just think of rho as some very slightly noisy version of a T state. And psi maybe is just a very small angle rotation of zero. Then the result really says that it is impossible to get from rho even to some vicinity of the psi, even though psi looks very much weaker than rho. So this rho could be much more useful in other tasks and take much larger value in terms of other resource monotones. But this transformation is rolled out. So this highlights the special role of the quantum hypothesis testing relative entropy monotone. Because other monotones do not really rule out the rho greater than psi partial order. So this is just a slide taken from Earl's talk. Well, yeah, there are some grammatical problems, but yeah. Yeah, at least in this setting, like this hypothesis testing relative entropy monotone is super special. All right, now let's transform our results. Let's work with a practically more relevant setting, which is sometimes called distillation. So here we often use a supply of raw resources and do some procedure on it in order to distill some higher quality target state. The application of such procedures are very extensively studied in many contexts. Our aim now is to minimize the cost of the task, that is the amount of the raw resources needed. So here, instead of considering this very very general task, we ask about the amount of some unit initial state, n. So this is the more formal definition of the total overhead. Now we are given n copies of some unit noisy premise rho, actually rho hat. And we want to output some pure state psi with epsilon error. And the cost, the total overhead or cost of this task is defined to be the minimum possible n that this is possible. So by simply transforming the no-go theorems, the error bounds, we can obtain the following conclusion. So notice that the base of these logs are not dependent on epsilon, so it's just a log. Then the number of unit noisy states needed will be greater than the log of some parameters over epsilon. So if we want to look at the asymptotic information, the total overhead scales at least as log 1 of epsilon. So all the previous results are general results that apply to any theory. So now let's get some concrete things in the context of Magistate distillation. So I'll say a few words because it hasn't been said in this conference, I think. So Magistate distillation is considered to be a leading scheme of fault tolerant quantum computing because the Clifford gates are considered to be low cost by, for example, stochastic codes to protect. But they're not universal. That is just the Gossmann-Knill theorem. Now we need to add non-Clifford gates, or sometimes called magic, for example, T gates, pi over a gates, to make the whole thing universal. But these non-Clifford gates are hard to protect. Well, a very nice method is to produce high-quality T gates in a separate factory and use this kind of state injection gadgets into the circuit to emulate the effect of T gates. That is, we can transform the problem of implementing very high accuracy T gates in the circuit to prepare some T gates, like T states, separately. Also, all these other things are Clifford. So the resource part is only the Magistate distillation. Any other component of the whole procedure is Clifford, so you can take it for granted. The Magistate distillation component is estimated to be a dominant source of resource cost in the whole scheme. So understanding the achievable efficiency of this component is of great importance. So common distillation protocols work like this. You encode the noisy T states in some stochastic code, and you do measurement, you post-select, and you decode. And what you get is some T state with smaller error. And suppose you want to achieve some very small target error, you just concatenate the code. You iterate the process. A very general formulation of the task is this. So you're given n full rank noisy magistates row. You output a large state. It can be many qubits or many qubits, but each marginal of the state is sufficiently close to the t states. A widely considered figure of merit of the efficiency of Magistate distillation protocols is the average overhead. So here we, so n is the total overhead we discussed before, and now we need to divide it by n somehow. Especially the exponent in the scaling of this form is of great interest. So assuming the success probability just doesn't go to zero under concatenation, this exponent gamma is related to the parameters of the codes by this expression. So this is the explicit form of the bound we get for T-state distillation. So here we express it in terms of the average overhead n divided by m in order to match what people consider about. So of course, for other target magistate of interest like CCZ state, you can just plug in corresponding parameters and get its bound. So let's consider what this bound means in terms of the usually considered overhead. So first of all, any sub-logarithmic protocols. Here, sub-logarithmic means that the exponent gamma is smaller than one in the average overhead. This is some very recent seminal results by Hastings and Ha and Aniru and Dilish. So what this bounds, says is that any such sub-logarithmic protocol must have rapidly diverging output size. So this diverging is not even the size of the input that grows exponentially when you need to concatenate the code. Is that if you look at the bound, the denominator is some log, but here the exponent is one. But in order to make the whole bound a sub-logarithmic thing, the m also has to converge, to diverge. Right? So although the average overhead is considered to be low, if you want some super small target error, the overall cost could just easily blow up. It blows up once in the size of the input, and also the output size, another factor, also needs to diverge when you want to decrease the target error. And the second information is that for any constant size output protocol, such as you do the measure state decision by concatenating k equals 1 code, then the average overhead is lower bounded by log. So in such cases, I believe the best known codes has gamma tending to 2. So there is still a gap between our lower bound and the best known protocol. All right, so this is the last result. Let's extend our attention to the channel setting. So the channel setting, the channel ritual theory setting is of some interest recently because it also it just directly applies to gates and dynamical processes and so on. So you can check out Rob's talk or this recent paper that has a general theory of the channel setting. So our no-go theorem is a very simple version. It's like this. So now you're given some noisy channel. This notion of noisy is a little bit technical. I'm not going to define that here. But just consider it to be roughly equivalent to the full rank assumption. So given some noisy channel N, and the target is you want to simulate some unitary resource channel U. Unitary is analogous to pure state. Then the no-go theorem says that no free superchannel can transform this noisy channel N to U with zero error. So this is a perfect simulation version. So this free superchannel, superchannel is a map that maps a channel to a channel. So this free superchannel has a very similar golden rule defined. It is also just the minimal requirement you want to place on channel theories. So you can understand this result as a zero error analog of the theory results. So of course, the proof is based on a channel analog of the hypothesis testing relative entropy. And maybe some boring reinterpretation of this result is that the zero error quantum capacity of generic noisy channels is just zero. All right, we are good on time. So let me summarize. So in this talk, we showed that nearly perfect purification of any resource by any free procedure is never possible for generic noisy systems. This draws some practical boundary for error correction and noise mitigation procedures. And also, by transforming the no-go theorems, we get the log one epsilon lower bound on the total overhead of decision type tasks. Here are some outlooks. So first of all, an important problem will be to investigate the achievability of these fundamental limits. Here, I believe no very general answers will be very satisfying. But for special theories, we can expect to get like almost matching bounds. And also, we should work on the approximate and probabilistic versions of the channel theory to develop a more complete framework that directly tackles gates and processes. So the last one is a pretty exciting one to me. So for a continuous variable, note that all the results I explained so far are in finite dimensions. So what about continuous variable quantum computing, which is very relevant, for example, in optical settings? So what we can do right now is that we can transplant the no-go theorem when the system is gapped. Here, the gap means that the spectrum of the noisy system doesn't just go all the way to zero. There is some finite smallest eigenvalue. Well, this is somewhat straightforward. But when it is gapless, I believe this is also pretty generic in continuous variable settings. What we see is that our no-go techniques do not carry over. Like both the two proofs, both proofs, do not really work. But also, at the same time, no distillation method that keeps improving the fidelity with respect to some CV analog of the magic states is really known, as far as I know. So the situation is that for this scenario, no lower bound and no upper bound is known. So there is an infinite playground that we can get results of. Okay, I believe that is what I want to talk about today. Thank you for your attention.
Thanks very much. So, some time for questions.
Thanks. So, I'm trying to get an intuition for why the bound depends on 1 over lambda min and how that makes sense. So, I follow the math because something weird about the 1 over lambda min. So you made an assumption saying, let's assume that the initial state is full rank.
Yeah.
So lambda min is
greater than zero, yeah.
Yeah, which kind of makes sense if you say, well, I've got a noisy state and it's got some noise on it. But as soon as you have a pure state, tensor on, lambda min is going to go to zero. So if I tensor on a pure stabilizer state, it's kind of like a cheat, really, but the bound becomes trivial. But tensoring on a stabilizer state is a stabilizer operation. So, like, if I can think, do you see what I mean?
Not really.
You're saying that the bound holds under all stabilizer operations. Yeah? So, tensoring on a stabilizer state is usually a stabilizer operation, right? So, if I have something where the bound says something non trivial, yeah? A tensor on a stabilizer state, then the bound would say something trivial because lambda min would be zero. So, like, how does it work?
So, are you worried about the full rank condition? I'm not totally getting the essence of your question. But here, like, So, for example,
it is weird that the bound becomes weaker as the state becomes purer, whereas you would expect it to become tighter, is it?
So here, the full rank assumption, we really need that for the continuity bound. So, for example, if we ask whether it's possible for perfect purification, so we consider a zero epsilon case, then we don't really need the full rank condition. We only need a weaker condition, which is called free component. Yeah, free component basically says that your state, you can write. You can write your state as some convex combination of two states where sigma is pure. It's even much weaker than full rank. So yeah, I'm not totally sure at this point to what extent we can remove the full rank condition for non-zero epsilon case, but we sort of need that and the proof of the continuity bound, which is this. Which is exactly this lemma. So yeah, so if the system is not full rank, a very technical step in the proof doesn't go over. So yeah, I'm not sure if I can give you more intuitive answers right now, but yeah.
Yes.
So is it really important that the graph that is some kind of linear in epsilon?
Sorry?
I mean, is it really important that the graph that is linear in epsilon and when you do the expansion?
Sorry, can you repeat your question?
So the log term, log?
The log term.
Lambda over lambda minus epsilon, if you expand the epsilon, it will be linear in epsilon.
What will be linear?
The graph that term.
The what of the term, sorry?
I mean the whole term in the right hand side.
Yeah.
It's just linear in epsilon in the first expansion. In the first order expansion.
First order, okay.
Right. So is it important to be the link to be linear?
Sorry, what do you mean? Is it important?
Like if I have a lower like bigger bound, like bigger than linear from like epsilon times log epsilon, then will the proof go through?
Oh yeah, it will. The proof does not rely on the inner features of this bound. It just directly carry over.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any other questions? If not, let's thank Siwen again.
Thank you.